KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Trump definitely doesn't want to support Ukraine, and he wants to make a quick peace. And this quick peace is possible only on terms of Mr. Putin.
How Ukraine is responding to that Oval Office clash between Presidents Trump and Zelensky. For Saturday, March 1st, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we will hear what it's like to report from the top of a moving freight train to document migration to the U.S.
And he stopped me and he said, "You will never understand what they go through unless you get on the train with them."
And the State Department is bracing to be the next government agency to face deep, drastic cuts. We will hear how longtime diplomats are preparing. And we will look at the unanswered questions about how Trump and Elon Musk's Doge effort is funded.
The origins of the funds are a bit obscure, and it would be helpful to get some answers from the administration on this.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Reactions continue to pour in from around the world over yesterday's argument between President Trump and Ukrainian leader Zelensky in the Oval Office. As NPR's Charles Maines reports, Trump is finding plenty of support in Moscow.
The Kremlin has yet to weigh in directly on the White House meeting, but prominent government officials took to social media to praise Trump for giving Zelensky what one called a public beatdown. While Zelensky has been largely lauded in the West for his leadership amid the Russian invasion, propagandists in Moscow have long depicted him as both fascist and corrupt. Russia's foreign ministry issued a statement seemingly designed to appeal to Trump's argument it was Kiev rather than Moscow holding up a potential peace deal. The ministry claimed that Zelensky had, quote, used lies and manipulation to continue fighting and bilk Western military aid, a view the current White House appears to share. Charles Maines, NPR News.
A group of immigrant rights and legal aid organizations has sued the Trump administration to try to stop the transfer of migrants from the United States to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has more.
The lawsuit does not challenge the U.S. government's authority to detain migrants on U.S. soil or deport them directly to their home country or another country allowed under immigration law. Instead, the American Civil Liberties Union and its partner civil rights groups argue it is illegal for the U.S. to first send those migrants to Guantanamo. The suit says there's no legitimate reason to do that because the government has ample detention capacity inside the United States, and it says holding migrants in the U.S. makes far more sense logistically and financially. The lawsuit alleges the reason the Trump administration is first sending migrants to Guantanamo is to instill fear in the immigrant community. Sasha Pfeiffer, NPR News.
Protests and rallies were held at national parks across the country today over the recent mass firings of federal workers, including those at the country's first national park, Yellowstone.
Gathered under the Roosevelt Arch at the park's north entrance, rallygoers showed support for federal public lands and recently fired employees. Richard Midget was hired in December to work in information technology for Yellowstone National Park, but was among those fired last month. He helped organize the rally.
We're not just protecting our parks for the next 100 years. We're trying to protect our parks for generations and generations.
Rallygoers say they worry that the effects will ripple beyond the parks to the communities that rely on the over $600 million spent each year by Yellowstone visitors. For NPR News, I'm Ruth Eddy in Gardner.
President Trump tonight signed an executive order making English the official language of the U.S. It's the first time in America's history that an official language has been named. It rescinds a Clinton-era mandate requiring agencies to be multilingual. This is NPR. Former New York Mayor Andrew Cuomo is running for mayor of New York City, this 3 years after he resigned amid allegations of sexual harassment. Mayor Eric Adams is running for re-election, but he's been dealing with a scandal for months after a federal indictment on corruption charges. The case is on hold, though, because the Trump administration's Justice Department want the charges dismissed. He denies the allegations. The primary will be held in June. David Johansen, the flamboyant frontman of the New York Dolls, died yesterday at his home in New York City at the age of 75. He had cancer. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports his band was short-lived but influential.
The New York Dolls rose to fame in the early 1970s with their brash sound and cross-dressing ways. The Dolls' albums flopped, but they influenced a wave of more commercially successful bands, including the Ramones, the Sex Pistols and the Smiths. David Johansen talked about the Dolls' origins on WHYY's Fresh Air in 2004.
It was like us against the world, and we were really trying to evolve music into something new.
Johansen was born on Staten Island into a middle-class family. After graduating high school, he gravitated towards New York's experimental performance scene. After the Dolls broke up in 1975, Johansen achieved acclaim with his martini-sipping, tuxedo-wearing alter ego, Buster Poindexter. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Hurst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. It has been a day since President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance publicly berated Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office. And as the images continue to play on a loop around the world, there is anger and dread in Ukraine. Zelensky is now in London, where he's preparing to meet with European Union leaders. And while Ukrainians are praising Zelensky for standing up for himself and their country, they are also wondering whether the Trump administration will now retaliate. NPR's Joanna Kakissis is in Kyiv. Hey, Joanna.
Hey, Scott.
So let's start with the reaction to what happened to the White House Friday. What are you hearing from Ukrainians?
So, Scott, I've been speaking with a lot of people in Kyiv, and so have our producers, Polina Litvinova and Hannah Palomarenko. And what people have been telling us is that they are very angry at how Zelensky was treated by Trump. They're calling it an ambush, a dirty trick to humiliate Zelensky into supporting a quick deal that benefits only Moscow.
The U.S. has been Ukraine's closest ally all along. Do Ukrainians feel betrayed?
Well, not exactly, because as you mentioned, the U.S. is so important to Ukrainians, and Ukrainians say to me, whenever I meet them, they're very grateful for American support. And Zelensky himself says that repeatedly in public speeches, thank you for the support. And Ukrainians have always admired the U.S. for its democratic values. But what I'm hearing from them is that they feel hostility, specifically from the Trump administration and from President Trump's hardcore supporters. Ukrainians don't know how to convince this administration that Ukraine is the victim here, not Russia. So we met Alina Dvoska, a 29-year-old recruiter, at a demonstration in central Kyiv about missing soldiers. Her father has been missing for 6 months. She says she believes the Trump administration is trying to gaslight Ukraine and Zelensky.
I absolutely support our president for defending the interests of our country. I understand that he was trying to act from a position of strength, because that's how you deal with these people.
We also spoke to Yevhen. He's a 43-year-old soldier who works in an air defense unit. He asked us not to use his last name for security reasons, and he said he believes the meeting went badly because Trump is seeking personal profit, not peace.
Trump would have no problem influencing Vladimir Putin if he wanted to. But to do so, he needs to think of the interests of America, Europe, and Ukraine, not his own interests.
Now, Trump had been pushing for this minerals deal with Ukraine. That's why Zelensky was at the White House. That deal was never signed, of course. There are also reports that the White House wants to cut off military aid for Ukraine. Are Ukrainians worried that an angry Trump could do that, could just cut them off?
Yeah, there's definitely real concern about that, because more than anyone, the Ukrainians want this war to end, but in a way that will keep Russia from attacking it again. And now they're really vulnerable. Several Ukrainians I spoke to wonder what will happen on the battlefield, or if Russia will keep hitting Ukraine's energy grid, or if there will be more Russian drones, which we hear almost every night already. Serhii Fursa, he's an investment analyst in Kyiv. He's worried about what will happen to Ukraine's economy, which of course has struggled during the war. But he also says Zelensky was put in an impossible position at the White House, and that even if he had sat quietly next to Trump, not much would have changed for Ukraine.
I think outcome will be almost the same, because Trump definitely doesn't want to support Ukraine, and he wants to make a quick peace. And this quick peace is possible only on terms of Mr. Putin.
Vladimir Putin, he says, seems to have all the cards, at least according to Donald Trump.
Zelensky is now in London meeting with European leaders. Is there hope that a tighter alliance with Europe might help Ukraine here?
Sure. Zelensky has talked about that. He's talked about a European army, which is a long way off, but something the EU is considering. We spoke to Lilia Alexeyeva, a 28-year-old marketing analyst, about this, and she sees hope, but she's also worried that if the war drags on, European support might wane. She said the Europeans want us to survive because we are the shield. We are protecting them from Russia. But, she said, I have no illusions. They won't send their own people to die for Ukrainians.
That's NPR's Joanna Kakissis talking to us from Kyiv, where people are still processing what happened yesterday. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
The Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has been tearing through the federal government, slashing budgets, firing staff. It has a mandate from both President Trump and Elon Musk to make federal agencies more efficient and transparent, as they put it. But who is making sure DOGE is efficient and transparent? And more specifically, who is monitoring how DOGE is funded and how much money it actually has? Avi Asher Shapiro is a reporter from ProPublica, and he and his colleagues are trying to do just that. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What have you and your colleagues been able to find out about how much money DOGE is spending, where that money's coming from?
So we were able to uncover that DOGE began with about a $750,000 infusion, and that quickly grew to about $40 million of money that had been apportioned for DOGE within the first month of the administration. Much of that money is supposedly under the banner of technology modernization work or IT work, but we don't know if that's the beginning or the end of it. We don't know if it's $40 million a month for the entirety of the initiative, which would be a staggering sum, or if it's $40 million for the entire year. And we don't know if that money is going to salaries, if it's going to equipment, really what it's being spent on. But we do have that number of $40 million that's been apportioned by the administration to DOGE so far.
What can you tell about where that money is coming from? Because there's so much conversation about congressional authorization on the downsizing side. Congress hasn't passed a bill to fund DOGE that much more, as far as I can tell.
The origins of the funds are a bit obscure, and it would be helpful to get some answers from the administration on this. Much of that money has been apportioned under something called the Economy Act, which, you know, experts told us basically allows agencies of the government to reimburse themselves for work that others do. So basically, it looks like agencies are paying DOGE out of their own pocket, which agencies we're not able to see, and we're not exactly sure for what work they're being paid for. So if it's money that's supposed to be set aside, for example, for IT work, but it's actually paying for other kinds of activities like mass layoffs or shuttering buildings, experts tell us that could raise some serious questions.
And obviously, you are looking at documents that you can access. You are talking to people throughout the government who are willing to talk to you. How much responses have you gotten to direct questions to DOGE officials? Are they responding to the questions, or are they ignoring them?
I can tell you that we have tried to reach dozens and dozens of people who we've identified through documents, through sources, through public records as being part of the DOGE initiative. And we have not been able to get on the record answers from a single member of DOGE. I actually saw for the first time a member of DOGE announced on Twitter that they were working at DOGE and said what they were working on, which was great and interesting, but we're not seeing that across the board. We're seeing members of DOGE actually erase their online histories, delete their LinkedIn profiles, make it more difficult to figure out who they are. So we're not getting clear answers.
Even as they massively reshape federal departments every single day.
Right.
What are legal experts telling you about all of this and about the transparency or lack thereof of where this funding is coming from?
Yeah, so the Trump administration has said that DOGE is covered by the Presidential Records Act, which means that it wouldn't be subject to the Freedom of Information Act requests immediately. But experts have told us that that might be a problem. If DOGE is dispatching team members to agencies, taking command of those agencies, taking command of significant work inside of those agencies, and it's funding itself with those agencies' budgets, then they may have to really comply with open records laws.
Right.
This is a kind of double bind that they're in.
Because if you're you know, the EPA or whatever, and reporters request information or anybody requests information, there is a set legal standard of having to disclose that information. And DOGE is getting around that by saying this is executive privilege.
I mean, there are experts and judges have even said that it looks like they're trying to have it both ways, right? They want, for the purposes of public records laws, they want to be, you know, within the executive office of the president. But mm-hmm. for the purposes of its control, command and control of agencies, they want to be an agency, right? And that's that exact kind of contradiction has been raised by judges who have been questioning the administration about DOGE's position.
That is Avi Asher Shapiro, a reporter from ProPublica. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Mardi Gras parades have a reputation for making a lot of trash, but some organizers are trying to change that by banning one of the most colorful Mardi Gras traditions, the tossing of plastic beads into the crowd. Matt Bloom with member station WWNO takes us on a recent parade on the streets of New Orleans, where plastic beads were notably absent.
Parade-goer Bonnie Hill waves her hands as a float shaped like a medieval castle passes by. Riders toss dozens of throws, as they're called, in the air. There's frisbees, a toy sword, stuffed animals, and more.
Oh my gosh, wait, what did you get there?
Glass beads.
Notably, much smaller than the usual plastic beads. The group putting this parade on, called the Crew of Ferret, used 250,000 strands of plastic beads last year. But this year, they're not using any.
I love that so many of the crews are doing that. It's so important. And they're throwing less.
At least two major parades have stopped using plastic beads altogether. That's because many end up in landfills or clog the city's drainage system.
Honestly, it was a very easy decision.
Bobby Hortzberg is captain of the Crew of Ferret. He says he came to the realization on Mardi Gras Day last year.
My one-year-old daughter was wearing a strand of beads, and I saw them start to, like, bleed onto her neck.
Meaning the paint color from the beads was staining her skin and clothes.
And I just, like, remember thinking to myself, like, what are we doing?
Now they're replacing beads with more useful throws, like packs of jambalaya ingredients.
I have cooked the jambalaya that I've caught in the parades, and it's delicious.
Sivia Hebert is on the sidewalk with her husband Tommy and daughter Lucy. The family is keeping an eye on the floats for a chocolate-covered moon pie.
And I got a cookie.
What kind?
Like a marshmallow cookie.
There's
like...
only one kind. It's moon pie.
They also caught a bag of red beans and sugar cubes throughout the night, which they say they definitely won't put to waste. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky got a warm welcome from the British Prime Minister in London today, this ahead of a summit of European leaders tomorrow. It's a stark difference to his meeting with President Trump and Vice President Vance at the White House yesterday, as both berated the Ukrainian leader over not appearing thankful enough. Late last night, federal employees got another email from the Office of Personnel Management, once again instructing them to provide 5 bullet points on their accomplishments last week. It's part of billionaire Elon Musk's efforts to cut the federal workforce. And in Alaska, a ceremonial start to the Iditarod dog sled race got underway today. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Kids are going to be kids wherever they are.
I remember there was this one kid who was putting plastic bottles on the train tracks just to see what happened to them.
This is Eder Peralta, NPR's Mexico City correspondent. It was December, and he was in a train yard in northwest Mexico.
So at some point, I gave him a little coin so he could put it on the train track and see what happened to it. And indeed, I had never done this before.
I did this when I was a kid. Yeah.
Yeah, and it flattens it, right?
Yeah.
It's like one of those machines.
This was a moment of downtime between many periods of acute motion. Hundreds of migrants were waiting for freight trains, hoping to jump aboard and ride north toward the U.S. border.
They have like their whole lives with them. You know, they have just bags full of coats and blankets, and they have jugs of water.
When a train would finally approach,
they're so heavy that like the earth beneath it sort of heaves as they move across, right? It almost feels like the gravity of the train pulls you toward it.
The trains moved so fast that jumping on directly would be impossible for most of the migrants.
So they have this term that they say, vamos a ponchar el tren, which translates to we're going to puncture the train. And so the young people, they will put on gloves, like a ski mask to protect their face and their eyes. And then as the train comes, they just sprint like right beside it, and they somehow jump on, and then they just start turning knobs and pulling levers. And what they're hoping will happen is that it disrupts the train's air brakes. And so that would usually cause an emergency stop.
The migrants Eder and his photographer were following finally found the train they wanted, and they got it to stop. They climbed up to the top of the train, and Eder and his colleague joined them. They all spent a frigid night riding north at 50 miles an hour. In Mexico, this train is called La Bestia, the Beast. For decades, migrants have been riding on top of it in a treacherous and often deadly leg of the journey to the U.S. border. Today, for our weekly Reporter's Notebook segment, we'll go on board La Bestia with Eder. His reporting started with a basic question. Why would migrants take this risk?
There was this Venezuelan woman who I met, and she had slung her little girl just on her shoulder.
Caminamos aún.
And I asked her, like, you know, why do this and why do this right now? And she sort of like looked at me, surprised, I think, at the question. And she said, you know, you guys think that the American dream is dead. But for us, the American dream is still very much alive. And I think what the explanation for that I got over talking to dozens of migrants is that the American dream is not this grand idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really simple idea. For her, it was that her two kids could get an education. I also met this mother and son from Venezuela as well, Brian and Yalitza.
who was his mom. And his mom was in her 50s and he was 23, right? And Yalitza's husband died, and she says she told Brian, you know, this is our chance. I've got nothing to lose. We can do this and you can find a better life now. And so they left. And so she told me why I'm doing this is because I think that Brian, my son, could become an entrepreneur. He can have a better life. And then talking to her son, he told me something much simpler, right? Which was that he had a little kid in Venezuela. And he hadn't been able to buy him a birthday present. What this trip could mean, what this American dream could mean, is that one day his kid could have a birthday present.
Even when the policy of the U.S. government right now is we don't want you,
yeah.
We don't want to give you any of these resources, we want to arrest you or deport you for the country or both.
Yeah, but I think another thing about these migrants, right, is that they've been told that throughout.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these migrants, they've been at this for years. You know, a lot of these Venezuelan migrants, you know, they first started in Colombia, and then, you know, they crossed the jungle in Panama, and then, you know, they went up to Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, right? And so we were catching these migrants at the tail end of a journey. I think that's a lot of why they're saying, we don't care what the American president says, we've been going through hell. And whatever he says is nothing compared to what we've already been through.
Let me turn the why question to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously the immigration story is a major part of your beat, but you can, and you have told that story a lot of different ways. Why to you was this story worth climbing on top of a two-story freight train and riding it as it traveled 50 miles an hour?
You know, this story was born out of a conversation I had with my wife. You know, we live in Mexico City, and Mexico City is a stop along the way for migrants. So you see a lot of migrant families. And my wife had a question, right? She was saying, I don't know that I have the capacity emotionally to put my family through a trip like this. And what she was saying is I have a hard time understanding migrants who do.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, you know, that's probably a question that many of our listeners have. I had met this Mexican photographer, Pedro Anza. I had met him in Haiti when we were doing some coverage in Haiti. And he rides this train a lot. He's working on a long-term project on this train. And he had told me, you know, you should ride the train. It gives you a very different understanding of the migrant experience.
Was he right? On the other side of that, did you feel like you understood this in a different way?
I did. I have to say, I didn't realize how hard this was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was coming off of an assignment in Lebanon. I was there as Israel started bombing. It was missiles and you could feel the force of them, right? So like, I was like, well, you know, what's getting on a train, right?
It's all relative.
I was wrong.
Yeah.
Scott, like that, we spent a 12-hour part of that train ride was at night. And it was in the high 30s. And that train is moving at 50 miles an hour. So like, just the wind, right?
Mm-hmm. And is there any cover whatsoever up there? I assume no.
No cover. And like one of the, there are these people who help the migrants. And this lady, like she saw me and the photographer I was with. And she said, you guys are crazy. Like, you don't know what you're getting into. And she gave us this very thin blanket. And I was like, I'm not going to take this. Give it to one of the migrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just here as a reporter. I'm not doing this. And she's like, you're going to want this. And so, like, I took it sort of with a little shame. And in the middle of the night, I was just holding on to that blanket.
It is freezing out here. Everyone just woke up. The train has picked up speed again. It's like 40 degrees.
It was difficult. And you're just, you know, there's so many people on that train that you can't You can't really move, but there's also like not really body warmth that you're getting like from other people. Nobody's talking. It's so loud. The wind, right? You're just like, you look up and all you see is like, there was like a full moon, right? And like, you really can't see anything on either side.
What were you like thinking about on like hour 6 or 7 or 8 sitting on top of this train? The sun.
The sun. Literally all I could think about is what am I doing? Like, why did we do this? And when is that sun going to come up?
That's a good segue, Ader, that you, I think probably more than anybody on staff right now at NPR, have a particular knack of finding yourself in tricky situations in the middle of a story and often maximizing that and using that situation to tell a better story and to understand the topic that you're covering even more and help listeners understand that. You've been detained in South Sudan. I remember hearing live on the radio when you were reporting on something as people were throwing rocks in, at the tin roof of the building you were in.
It was in Kenya.
In Kenya, as you did a live radio hit. How do you generally think about the pros and cons, and at what point it's not worth it to keep going for you personally?
I think my editor always tells me, like, Ader, you know, the chaos will be there tomorrow, right? Whatever chaos that is, right? Haiti will be there tomorrow. She's like, let's take a breath. Because my instinct, right, as a journalist is let's go. I grew up in Miami, and the first house we stayed at, it was like a corner house and like a big intersection, right? And so there was always car crashes, and like no one could keep me from going to see the car crash, right? It was like the thing I did. So like I always want to run toward things, but I there's always a conversation between me and my editors about risk versus benefit. It's interesting because on this train, I had a different opinion than my photographer friend. You know, we had gotten on a couple of trains and they were moving in the wrong direction. Everybody got off. And I was not comfortable on top of that train. You know, you're two stories up. I'm afraid of like Ferris wheels. So like, I don't like heights.
I'm with you on that. I can do roller coasters, but Ferris wheels, the slow height of
same.
It, no.
And then like sometimes, you know, you have to walk on top of those things and you have to jump from cart to cart. And that
I clenched up hearing that part of the story as you described it.
That made me really uncomfortable. I rarely am physically scared, right?
Yeah.
I was physically scared. And I sat down at some point with Pedro Anza, the photographer who was with me on this trip. And I said, I'm not doing this. And I'm like, we won't even use it for the story, I said. Because actually, in the end, we used about one paragraph of that awful 12 hours overnight of freezing cold. And so in my mind, I was making that calculation, right? And he stopped me and he said, you will never understand what they go through unless you get on the train with them.
Ader, I want to end this conversation the way you ended this story, because the fact is, for a lot of these people, maybe even a majority of these people, all of this long, long journey, which, like you said, the very end of is riding across the desert, freezing cold on the top of a train, it's all for naught, because you end the story by talking about a family who they make it across the border. They turn themselves in and seek for asylum, and they're immediately kicked out of the United States. And yet, as you write in the story, they, the next day, start heading north again.
Yeah. You know, just as President Trump took office, I was in Ciudad Juarez at the border, and I actually met some of the same migrants that had been on the train with me.
Same people.
The same people. And they were waiting in line because they had gotten a CPP1 appointment, which is this app that the Biden administration used to have. And that's kind of like, that is the glimmer of hope. That was the glimmer of hope for so many migrants, right? And on that day, Trump takes the oath of office and that app goes offline just minutes after he does. And the heartbreak on that international bridge, it's hard to describe, honestly. You're just watching somebody's world crumble in a few minutes. And to know, I guess, to have felt what it's like for a little tiny period, right, of how hard that journey is, to watch it crumble on that day, I think it's difficult.
That's Ada Peralta, Mexico City correspondent for NPR. Ada, thanks for walking us through one of your stories and helping us understand how you think about all of this.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Trump administration's push to downsize the federal government could hit the State Department next. Ambassadors have already been asked to look for ways to cut back at U.S. embassies around the world, and there is speculation that some embassies could be shut down or consolidated. Advocates for the State Department say this could hurt America's ability to support American businesses and interests abroad, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
When Secretary of State Marco Rubio arrived at the State Department on his first day, he told his staff that he wanted the State Department to be at the center of U.S. foreign policy making.
There will be changes, but the changes are not meant to be destructive. They're not meant to be punitive. The changes will be because we need to be a 21st century agency that can move, by a cliche that's used by many, at the speed of relevance.
In the week since, the Trump administration has dismantled the lead U.S. aid agency, sending termination letters to thousands of employees and preparing to pull back foreign service officers who work at USAID missions at embassies abroad. Thomas Yazgardi, president of the American Foreign Service Association, says diplomacy, development, and defense are all key parts of American national security.
We're looking at the development side really taking a huge hit. And the diplomacy side, if it happens, will just mean less American influence in the world, less ability to reach out, establish relationships, even with those governments which we don't agree with. We still need to be there.
The Biden administration opened new embassies in the Pacific and brought in the largest class of Foreign Service officers in years. Yazgardi says the department was only just recovering from cutbacks from the last Trump administration, and there's a deficit of mid-career officials who keep embassies running.
If we had a deficit from before and we're adding to that, well, you can imagine what that's going to do with our influence and our ability to shape events and protect our interests, advance our values. And when that happens, you tend to cede the field to your rivals, particularly China. There's no issue with China having enough funding to staff up their embassies. In fact, China has more diplomatic missions than we do right now.
In addition to planned cutbacks, President Trump recently signed an executive order to reform the State Department to make sure it, quote, effectively and faithfully implements his foreign policy. Secretary Rubio and his team have not explained how they will do this.
There's opportunity and risk in this executive order.
That's Dan Spakajny, a former Foreign Service officer who now runs FP21, an organization that's been proposing reforms. He says it's not enough to just play defense.
If the new administration is able to take its time and get it right, there could be some really positive changes. If they rush and don't think about the consequences of their action, then it could jeopardize our national security.
The example of USAID has given everyone pause.
This is crazy.
Gail Smith ran USAID in the Obama administration and watched this week as longtime employees were given just 15 minutes to clear out their desks.
I didn't think cruelty was an American value. That's not the way I was raised.
But it's not just how long-term federal employees are being treated. Smith worries that the government is losing expertise on development, disaster assistance, food aid, and health care.
The notion of lopping off bits of the government without analysis or rigor or consultation is a risky proposition. I mean, they're destroying an asset of the U.S. government that's been very valuable.
The State Department is expected to take over some of the functions, but it itself is bracing for cuts. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
To create a bulldog of a Victorian-era bare-knuckled boxer, actor Stephen Graham started with his walk.
I'm a great observer, like if I'm at a train station or an airport, and I watch people's walks, and I steal them and lock them away.
Stephen Graham on the new TV series, A Thousand Blows. That and the latest in politics, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The Pentagon is deploying up to 3,000 additional troops to the U.S.-Mexico border as part of President Trump's efforts to prevent illegal crossings. The latest deployment comes despite a sharp drop in border crossings. A senior Hamas official says there's been no progress in the latest rounds of talks on the second phase of the Gaza ceasefire deal between Israel and the Iranian-backed militant group Hamas. It's not clear whether the talks will resume. And a FedEx cargo plane traveling from Newark to Indianapolis struck a bird during takeoff this morning, damaging one of the Boeing 767's engines. The plane made an emergency landing in Newark. Officials say there were no injuries. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
Hey, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. It has been about 4 years since a major blackout in Texas. Millions of people were in the dark for days after a huge winter storm knocked out power plants across the state. Hundreds of people died. And since then, a lot of Texans have been nervous about their power grid. A podcast out of member station KUT in Austin has been looking at Texas's grid, what's changed and what hasn't since the deadly blackout. It's called The Disconnect, Power, Politics, and the Texas Blackout. In its latest season, they are zooming in on the role the state's natural gas system played in the disaster. It begins almost 100 years ago, at the very beginning of the oil and gas industry in Texas. Co-hosts Mose Bushell and Audrey McGlinchey tell the story of how a legendary con artist discovered an ocean of oil in East Texas.
So to learn about this, we're also going to hear from a guy who knows a ton about all of this stuff.
My name is Paige Foshee. 40 years of my life were devoted to being an oil and gas landman.
A landman is someone who works for an oil company, and they go to landowners and try to get them to lease their land so that they can drill for oil.
But Paige is also a historian and a writer, and his family is, in fact, his family on his dad's side is from the very part of East Texas that we're going to be talking about.
My father took me to see his side of my family when I was 11 in 1965, and I spent 2 weeks with my grandmother. I'd never seen pine trees before, nor oil derricks 80 and 100 feet tall, and I thought about the oil business and compared it in my mind to gold strikes and rushes. I found it, and still do, I find it romantic.
And it is. It's a history full of gamblers, underdogs, and Conan, like the one we're going to be talking about in particular.
Columbus Marion Joyner.
But for reasons you'll soon understand, he came to be known as Daddy or Dad Joyner.
And Dad had been working the East Texas field for 20 years.
Joyner's official job was a lot like Paige's. He would go out, convince landowners to lease their properties so they could drill oil. And in exchange, everyone would usually get a cut of future profits.
Right, and this is where the con comes in. See, after he got the lease, Joyner would get a bunch of investors together to raise money to drill. And this is a pretty normal way of financing a kind of independent oil project. The thing is, in the case of Dad Joyner, he appeared to have no intention of actually finding oil.
Absolutely. If you found oil, you blew it.
See, as long as he did not find oil, he never had to pay anyone back. He could just keep gathering up new investors, and taking all their money.
He would drill and drill and drill, and he would sell parts of oil well projects. Hey, I'll sell you 25% of my well for, you know, $5,000.
Yeah, he could sell the same project to different people multiple times over.
He really made a ton of cash by overselling every well he drilled. That's where his income came from.
As long as he failed, he never had to pay anyone, because they had invested in the hope of future profits that would come when Dad Joyner struck oil, which he was never going to do.
Like, these days you might get, I'll pay you in stock options on this startup or whatever, you know, but it's like, it's almost the same thing, right?
Oh, certainly. It's not a new story. It's probably one of the oldest.
And when it came to targets, like marks for this particular con, Joyner allegedly specialized in doctors and widows.
Yeah, he was especially kind to widows and maiden women. The older and with more property, the better.
He bragged about knowing a special place on a widow's neck. If he touched it, she would write him a check.
Oh, he was a master of amore.
So in 1927, Joyner was drilling for oil on the property of a widowed woman in Rusk County in East Texas. Her name was Daisy Bradford.
Joyner had gotten the lease from Bradford, and he'd pulled together a lot of investors to fund this drilling.
So it's 1927, and he drills his first well. It's called the Daisy Bradford Number 1. Well, at the time, I don't think it was called the Number 1, but they call it the Daisy Bradford Number 1 because he drilled it and there was no oil, right? This is what they call a dry hole. But for Dad Joyner, that was no problem, right? It was an opportunity to go out and get more investors.
So a couple years go by, it's 1929, Joyner drills another well, the Daisy Bradford Number 2. And what do you know? Also dry.
I think the trouble with the Daisy Bradford Number 1 and 2 wells was they didn't drill deep enough.
So Joyner got more money together, wrote more IOUs, and started drilling on a third well. And this third oil well, it started to show promise, signs of oil and gas coming up with the mud and water below.
At this point, the local people around Joyner couldn't help but notice that he seemed uneasy with this. He actually brought in one of his longtime partners to take over operations, a guy named Doc Lloyd.
Practice as a doctor, you know, without the formality of a license.
And again, it seemed to Daisy Bradford and others that Joyner and Lloyd were maybe trying to screw this up.
They were looking for dry holes.
So at this point, Bradford and the other workers on the site wrestled control of the operation from Joyner. Basically, Daisy Bradford used her position as landowner to have him sidelined. And that's probably why the Daisy Bradford Number 3 struck oil in October 1930.
It came in big.
So there's a book about all this called The Last Boom, which I highly recommend if you can get your hands on it. And in it, there is a description of the moment that Dad Joyner realized that Daisy Bradford 3 was a winner. And it says he did not dance a jig. No. He did not shout for joy. They say he just kind of briefly closed his eyes and leaned against a nearby tree. His expression kind of blank.
He could not have been happy. He'd oversold that well just like all the rest of them.
Joyner knew he was in trouble. What he could not have known was that the Daisy Bradford Number 3, that third oil well, had uncovered the biggest oil field in U.S. history.
So this is how he got his nickname, right? Columbus Marion Joyner was renamed the father of the field, hailed by East Texas as Dad or Daddy Joyner in the newspapers.
Which means his investors came knocking.
It was just terrifically fortuitous for everybody except Dad Joyner, who died broke in the late 40s. And I shouldn't laugh, but he was a scammer, and I don't have much sympathy for that.
Mose Bouchel and Audrey McGlinchey are the hosts of The Disconnect, a podcast about energy in Texas from member station KUT in Austin. You can listen to it wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow night is the Oscars, that annual event where we get our fill of the glitz and glam of Hollywood and also get to see if the Academy got things right, or as many of us usually think, got things wrong. When the nominations came out in January, many movie lovers celebrated nominees like Coleman Domingo for the prison drama Sing Sing and Demi Moore for The Substance. But some beloved performers did not make the cut, like Nicole Kidman for Baby Girl or Angelina Jolie for Maria. It is a reminder that year in, year out, whether it's the nominations or the winners themselves, Oscar voters can get it very, very wrong. Some Oscar blunders fall into the category of snubs. Others show a failure to recognize films that will endure. The Academy on the wrong side of history. To talk about how that happens, what it means, and why we should care, I recently sat down with NPR film critic Bob Mondello and our own producer and film fanatic, Mark Rivers. So, Bob, is there one particular movie that always jumps out to you as, like, an iconic miss?
Oh, my God, yes. It was the first Oscars that I paid attention to. It was in 1968. It was the year that Oliver won Best Picture. Oliver, Oliver, won't ask for more when he knows what's in store. And the biggest movie of the year, the most exciting movie I had ever seen in my life, came out.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
2001, A Space Odyssey, and it didn't get nominated.
It didn't even get nominated.
What kind of crazy is that? Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I just sort of said, okay, the Oscars are stupid.
And here you are.
This is crazy.
My first Oscars was probably in 2004, and this was the year that Lord of the Rings, Return of the King ran the table on everybody. And mm-hmm. that was my favorite movie at the time. So watching it, I was thinking, oh my God, your favorite movie's just going to win all the awards? This is great. And then I quickly realized the following year that was not going to be the case. There have been many an omission, many a snub in Oscar history.
I feel like there's two kinds, right? There's the, it didn't even get nominated. The Academy is just mm-hmm. on a different planet than a lot of moviegoers. And there's the, it was nominated, but it somehow lost. And I think to me, like, I guess we are going on 20 years later. Like, I still think about Brokeback Mountain losing to Crash, which was like this cartoonish algorithm of a dumb movie plot that was heavy-handed, and Brokeback Mountain was so good in so many different ways. And that caused like a bit of a scandal in an uproar for a while of like why the voters voted one way as opposed to another.
Almost always there's a good reason. Yeah. I mean, let me rephrase that. There's a dumb reason that makes no sense, but that makes sense to the Academy somehow. I mean, for instance, another movie that was not nominated is Singing in the Rain. Today it's regarded as a classic musical.
It is
one of the great musicals. It's arguably the great movie musical, right?
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain.
But back then, it came out the year after American in Paris won the Oscar for Best Picture. They were not going to give another Best Picture to a Gene Kelly musical. It just wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. Another example is Apocalypse Now. Mm-hmm. How could you not give Apocalypse Now the award for Best Picture? But the year before, Deer Hunter won. And so that would look like the Academy was obsessed with Vietnam and they didn't want to be obsessed with anything. Mm-hmm. And so they shifted and they gave it to Kramer versus Kramer.
Ted, I'm leaving you. Here are my keys. Here's my American Express card. Here's my Bloomingdale's credit card. Here's my checkbook. I've taken $2,000 out of our savings account because that's what I had in the bank when we first got married.
Was this some kind of joke?
Here's the cleaning.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to mention about Kramer v. Kramer. Like, I think looking back now, obviously, as Bob said, that you have this kind of like timid domestic drama going up against this grand operatic vision by Francis Ford Coppola. But Kramer v. Kramer was not considered the kind of like, you know, it wasn't weak in its time. And this was critically acclaimed. Right. So this was an example of a movie where the audience, critics, and the Oscars all converged. I feel like it's something that doesn't happen as much these days. You'll find more modest successes winning Best Picture, and there's a kind of complaint that you'll find lately about, are the Oscars out of touch?
I think there's one of the interesting trends that you see at different points in history is kind of this big movement happening that people are responding to in theaters. Mm-hmm. And the Academy itself, the people who make it up, don't quite like the direction that Hollywood is moving, mm-hmm. and they snub it. And I think, Mark, The Dark Knight is an example
the big Christopher Nolan epic Batman movie, the one where Heath Ledger plays Joker, changed the way movies were made.
It changed the way movies were made. It changed the way, it changed the Oscars.
Because it didn't get nominated.
It infamously did not get nominated. I remember at the time, there was someone who came out from the Academy who said, you know, when they voted to change the rules to allow more nominees, you know, to extend from 5 to 10, it was part of the discussion where they said, you know, The Dark Knight was in our mind when we did this. Mm-hmm. I think The Dark Knight being snubbed is an example of just what voters are comfortable with, right? I think you see biopics a lot. You see the kind of historical dramas.
It's the moderate approach that wins. And what I'm thinking of is Driving Miss Daisy versus Do the Right Thing.
Oh, yeah.
What kind of sense does that make, right? Driving Miss Daisy is a nice, polite movie about race.
You're speeding, I can see it.
We're only doing about 19 miles an hour.
I like to go under the speed limit.
It has the word Daisy in it.
Exactly, like exactly.
It is, it is, and
it's
a word of
it's an adaptation of an off-Broadway hit, a theatrical hit. Do the Right Thing was just like an explosion happening.
Yeah, Spike Lee's movie from 89 about simmering racial tensions on a neighborhood block in Brooklyn, New York.
Hey, Sal, how come getting the police on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do.
I remember reading contemporaneous reviews of it where, you know, some people thought that black people were going to riot at the end of the movie. So people were legitimately losing it over Do the Right Thing. And Driving Miss Daisy was like a hug, you know, it kind of tucked you in at night. And Do the Right Thing was a slap across the face telling you to wake up, you know, wake up to the realities of race relations.
Let me ask the flip side of this. Are there years that jump out to you in that the Oscars got it right? They perfectly put their finger on that moment in cinema, that moment in pop culture, and there was the right movie, and they picked it.
I have a couple moments, but Bob, you want to go ahead?
I know. I'm thinking.
Did
they ever pick the right movie?
Come on.
No, seriously. I think the whole notion of art as a horse race is stupid, just dumb.
But if we're going to do it, you know, if we're going to do it. And I think about a year that arguably contained the biggest Oscar blender of all time, the infamous Moonlight La La Land envelope mix-up.
Oh, okay.
And you'll recall when a number of producers got on stage and actually gave thank you addresses before they realized the wrong movie was announced.
I'm sorry. No. There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I look at Moonlight, which I think not only was the best movie of its year, 2016, but also one of the best picture winners of all time. I think Moonlight was representative in a lot of ways of how the industry and by proxy how the society wanted to kind of view itself as far as what stories it valued. I mean, you look at La La Land and Moonlight, you have this big Hollywood production, these two bright white stars. And
about LA.
About LA,
Hollywood,
it's about Hollywood.
Sense.
And then you have Moonlight, this really small, intimate drama about, you know, a gay African-American coming of age.
Yeah.
And what you have there is this movie came at the tail end of the Obama years. And Obama represented this historic expansion of what a black person could do or be in this country, right? Mm-hmm. And Moonlight, to me, represented an expansion of the kind of black stories we could tell, how they could look, how they could move, how they could feel. When something like Moonlight does win, I think it does send a message to not only audience members, it sends a message to other directors and filmmakers who say, well, you know, I may not have a La La Land in me, but I do have a Moonlight in me. Mm-hmm, and maybe that can get
represented. Or a Hurt Locker.
Or a Hurt Locker.
I mean, yeah, when those happen, it is magical.
Exactly.
It's really great. It shakes things up.
For sure. And I think we look to the Oscars to shake things up. They rarely ever do, but when they do, I think it's worth noting.
It's NPR's Bob Mondello and Mark Rivers. Thanks to both of you.
Great fun.
Thank you, Scott.
For Saturday, that is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. We will be back tomorrow. I hope you'll join us, and thanks for listening. Till then, have a great night.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.